Hi, you're listening to the Fictoplasm podcast, where we discuss our favourite works of fiction and how to turn them into role-playing games of some form or another. I'm your host, Ralph. There may be a few spoilers. Hello, welcome to another episode of Fictoplasm. This is a special episode. I'm joined by two special guests, one who's been with us before, and we're doing it as a collaboration with the Tabletop Role Players Book Club. So I'd like to welcome back Paul Michener.
Hello there, everyone.
And a new guest who is Ray Otis.
Hello.
What we're doing is talking about your book club choice for April, is that correct?
I believe that's right.
Before we go into introduce the book, Ray, would you like to talk a bit about the Tabletop Role Players Book Club and how you organise yourselves and how long you've been going for?
Oh, goodness. Yes, I can do that. We've been around for several years now. It's a Google Plus community, and actually started off on a forum even before that. So I would say, all told, we've probably been at it for 4 or 5 years at this point. We have a book a month that we read. So there's a whole month to read the book, and then we spend usually about a week to a week and a half discussing it asynchronously through Google Plus. So there's no live connection. It's just somebody tosses out a set of questions and is designated to lead the discussion, and then we kind of chip in as time permits. And we try to put a little bit of a bent on it, as you do, on how the book relates to our role-playing hobby.
Yeah, look, I guess doing it on social media like that means that you can have multiple contributions at once, which is the benefit we have there.
Yes, and it's very convenient for people to drop in and out. You know, people's schedules vary a lot, and so if you can't read a book on a certain month, you can take a month off and then come back very easily, and the club is still there.
Fantastic. Well, Ray, would you please introduce the April book choice?
Certainly. We read Pavane. It's an alternate history fix-up novel by Keith Roberts, meaning it contains a series of related short stories that were originally published separately. The book has 6 stories, or measures, followed by a coda set some years after the events of the final tale. And the term measures and coda are a reference to the title Pavane, which is a type of stately dance. The bulk of the novel is set in Dorset, England, in the year 1968. But it's a very different 1968 from our own history. The seminal event where our timelines seem to have diverged was the assassination of Queen Elizabeth in 1588. And then the wars that occur in the aftermath destroy Protestantism, leaving the Roman Catholic Church supreme. The influence of the church has retarded scientific progress. There's no telephones, no ubiquitous electricity, no petroleum engines. Instead, there's semaphore telegraphy, steam locomotives, and sailing ships. And the language of the elite is Norman French. The language of the church is Latin. And so we have a Great Britain that's very much controlled by outside influences. There's even some truly backward practices like confession compelled by torture that remain. The novel's primary tension is between the church and science and the old ones. Outlying areas are still relatively wild and are inhabited by dangerous animals, outcasts, rebels, and fairies, which I think is something we must talk about at some point in this discussion.
Absolutely, yeah.
yeah, and the writing is lyrical, I think, and heavy on setting details. The stories are more slice of life than what you think of as kind of a traditional plot. Mm. They're not always happy stories. They don't always have neat endings. They are, however, in my opinion, really poignant and engaging. The characters' lives feel real, and their stories lend some verisimilitude to the setting. The first, fifth, and sixth measures in the coda have related characters, each separated by a generation, but the other stories are just related by setting. And I'm not one that has read a lot of alternate history, which is what this genre is. But my frame of reference may be a little anemic, but I do think it was an excellent read. I really enjoyed the book.
I'm glad to hear that. I mean, I was pushing to do this amongst our group anyway, and so it's turned out to be a happy collaboration. Okay, so that was a good overview. Now we've got 6 stories in the book. I don't propose to go through all of them because doing a synopsis on each one I think would be excessive, but we might want to point to them as examples when we come to discuss the themes. So I was wondering, Paul, would you like to comment on any of the particular themes that stood out that you are particularly interested in?
Okay, so in terms of, you know, I mean, you know, Ray correctly said these stories are slice of life type events without these endings. At the same time, they're not necessarily ordinary moments in life. And within the expansion of the setting within the stories, it often goes into quite some detail about a character's past before the events that come up in the story. So, I mean, one thing that's very interesting is, again, the sort of this overbearing, overwhelming Catholic Church retarding science. This isn't incidental to move holding things back, it's a deliberate move. So that comes up in the next, I think it's story number six.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be an interesting one to talk about. And again, you mentioned fairies. I mean, there are references to these old ones, their mysterious ways, their symbols. It's not clear to me that they are anything other than, I don't know, some people who are living for it, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not clear they are some supernatural force.
Well, let's dig into that, because, first of all, let's talk about where the fairies are most prominent. They turn up in the second story, The Signaller, and then they're referenced in the third story, Brother John, and then, of course, in Lords and Ladies, which is the fourth one, and that title is, and particularly it's an allusion not only to the social structure, but also to the idea of the fairies, who are the lords and ladies. And they have an affinity to this symbol which is drawn, which we learn the most about in the coda, and it is described as a crab symbol, right? In fact, Ray, I think you had some attempts in drawing it. Is that correct?
Yeah, yes, I did. The early on, for the first six measures, that you're right, it's described as a crab-like scratching or intersecting lines, and then in the coda we get kind of almost a mechanical description of it. And so I did some attempts to doodle out a version.
The first question I've got is, do you think the fairies are real, as in fantastic liminal creatures who do not exist wholly in the world of humans? I'll throw that out to Ray.
Yeah, I think the question is answered a bit in the final measure. The seneschal that is there at the Corfe Gate story. Correct my pronunciation. How is that pronounced, by the way?
It's Corfe.
Corfe. Okay, sorry. So Corfe at the Corfe Gate story. But leading up to that, there's these references to the old ones. They seem to be associated with the Heath, which is kind of the area around in the region. It's a major feature of the region. It's kind of the wild, as it were, in the setting. And when they come at the end of The Signaller, there seems to be, at that point, I had some real doubt. I thought maybe these really are a different race, a different species, you know, a fairy-like race. But towards the end, I feel like they answer the question. I don't know how much we want to get into spoilers, but I feel like for me, it was more of a way of describing some mystery that the rebels and some different factions sort of surrounded themselves in, and a way for people who didn't understand what was happening to kind of explain it to themselves. So when these people would have an influence on the story, they would leave the marks behind, and then other people would attribute it to the fairies. That was kind of my impression by the end.
Paul, what's your view?
Okay, so it's interesting. So bringing up the Signaller, of course, until it got to the mention of the marks, I just assumed the fairies were, well, a dying hallucination of this.
Indeed, yes.
But coming up to it, I think you're right. It's a code. It's something that those who are not adhering to, you know, the established order use. It's a signal. And again, these stories. Well, you can imagine it saying, oh, it was the lords and ladies. That's almost said sarcastically.
Indeed.
That becomes established. I mean, I do like the fact that this was never absolutely confirmed.
The Signaller, it does feel like a hallucination, and it's like they're playing on local superstition. One of the things that I think is really important to think about about this. Let's say at the moment that yes, you're right. It's superstition that's being leveraged by outsiders for their own ends. The reason that it works is, unlike today, where we have the benefit of things like electric light and we have much more populous lands, and we generally have a lot more traffic. In this alternate 1968, it doesn't have electric light and it does not have a populace who can come and go with the freedom that illumination gives you. There's, I don't know if you know Tim Harford's series, which is like 50 objects that change the economy. One of them is about the light bulb, and it points out how expensive it used to be to light houses. And I was having a conversation with him about it. And he was talking, of course, in economic terms about how much it costs to light things. At the time, I was thinking, yeah, light is really important. When you have light sources being scarce or expensive, then you have only the rich can really afford to have illumination around their property. But what you then get is a scarcity of light, and you get a sharp division between night and day. And you've also got this area, if sparsely populated compared to today, you will have a populace who are more, I think, more likely to believe in ghosts and fairies and the sensation of the supernatural than we would today, because simply they're living in an environment where they're more suggestible to that.
I mean, it's the fact, isn't it, that at night, without, you know, cheap artificial lighting, darkness is going to be absolute.
Exactly.
You're going to go to bed when it's nightfall.
I mean, you've got to think about what this area looks like. And okay, the region that we're talking about, it is quite rural anyway, but there is absolutely no sodium lighting. There will be no light pollution. And of course, when you get out into rural parts of England, then the sky becomes enormous and awe inspiring. And I guess, I don't know, where you're located in the US, Ray, but, obviously, once you get away from a city, then you can see that it changes the whole sensation of the environment.
Absolutely. I live in San Diego now, but I grew up in Indiana, uh-huh, in the middle of nowhere, and in a farming area. And so when it was dark at night, you couldn't see your hand in front of your face. And we used to... you know, have fun kind of scaring ourselves, actually. We would go out and do things in the dark. And I remember one time specifically going fishing, and we went a little early, maybe, than we thought we'd get it on it early, right? So about 4:30 or 5 in the morning, we're wading in this creek, and it's still very dark, and the little, can't think of the word, crawdads, we call them. They're like tiny lobsters. We're pinching our feet, and we were about to go out of our minds we were really frightened at the time. It was, you know, we were thinking snakes and all kinds of, it's very quickly that your sense of civilization is, you know, falls away when you get into a very dark area like that.
This is the thing. I can imagine that far from the 1960s England that we would expect, where you have an increasingly secular populace, and you have modern conveniences coming in, and yes, there will be, certainly it will be dark at night, but at the same time you have a general, you have less of a belief in fairies than the world I'm imagining, where people are technologically disadvantaged, and therefore they are tending towards superstition, so it becomes an ideal propaganda tool. And I'm going to come back to this in the role-playing bit as well, because this is the bit I think is quite fascinating.
I do think Paul's right that they do leave the question open, even as they're sort of answering it in the final story about the fairies, though. And I really dig how they describe the Seneschal there. It says, certainly no one else could have understood his thoughts at the time, the old thoughts, the first thoughts of the first people ever, for he was of the ancient kind. And then later it remarks that she calls him by the name that he would have been known in his old speech. They don't give the name. But so there's this very, at that point, I'm torn between the idea that they're normal people with shrouded in mystery that are rebels, and that they're literally like another species that are kind of influencing the events of humankind. Is that where, is that the doubt that was left in your mind too?
Yeah, there was a doubt there. Exactly right. It did answer it. Well, like I said, it didn't answer it.
Mm-hmm.
After lingering doubt.
Well, one of the things I'm thinking of is that you, obviously these different point of view characters have been chosen because they have a particular experience of the fairies in one way or another. And I think in Lords and Ladies, Margaret basically directly converses with one, which I'm really not sure what that is supposed to be. And then Brother John in the third one, his vision is much more, is on a much larger scale, and it takes in the whole state of being and the concepts of the old gods versus the new, and the formation of the heavens and the stars itself, and choirs of angels and all sorts of things. And I'm thinking all the time that these could well be hallucinations, and there could be a reason why each of them is hallucinating like this. But they are so similar, then it's also, I think you can at least entertain the idea that they are part of a guiding, you know, non-human hand, or at least another organization that is parallel to normal human civilization and is observing us for some reason. I think the most important thing is that doubt is interesting and crucial and very entertaining to the reader. So I certainly, as one of the things I keep coming back to the Signaler, I very much enjoy it, and the way that you do feel like it is his experience of the fair folk is, it sounds like a wishful dream. And we know it's not objectively, but what if it is? I mean, doesn't that makes it, that adds an extra dimension, that adding to the fantastic. What other themes do we want to talk about?
I mean, one thing I wanted to talk about a bit, as well as what I mentioned earlier, was this idea of the sequence of history and people just being caught up in events.
Yep.
So there's a, mm-hmm. you know, the plane, this formal dance that people are going through while events unfold around them, and, you know, use them for this as part of this dance. So that is a definite theme there in the sequence of things. You know, the individuals aren't important. I mean, on the other hand, as an alternate history, it does spring out from one specific event. You know, the assassination of Elizabeth I, one individual. So there's an interesting contradiction there.
I think one of the things that strikes me is that it's bookended by the prologue on the coda, and we are external observers to that. So in some ways it's deeply speculative, and there's a question about, well, yes, of course it's a work of fiction, but it is also a work of imagination, and it's an imagination, an exercise by the external observer looking at these different slices of life.
I think that's right. I think the characters are there because of their ongoing generational almost relationship to these events. I thought the relationship between the Strange family, which is the, we see Jesse in the first story, who's the locomotive operator, and then his niece, I believe, and then her child, you know, they have this relationship with the fairies that reminds me of, I don't know if you've ever read Little Big by John Crowley, but it has
yes.
that kind of same, yeah, the same kind of generational relationship. But then there's also this ongoing relationship between those people in technology and are the characters in technology. So we have, you know, a locomotive operator, we have a signaler, we have different people who are engaged in the sort of technological advance or the lack of technological advance. I just think that these, is Paul's certainly right. When I say slice of life, they aren't, you know, just watching people cook, you know, or go and mow the lawn. You know, they're definitely caught up in big events that kind of tell the. But ultimately, I feel like the biggest character in Pavane is the setting. You know, it's not we all these people are kind of windows onto like this living, breathing setting that we watch unfold over time. And that's it, to me, I thought that was really powerful.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. One thing I would say that the focus on the setting as the character and more to the point as a sort of a speculative entity, a deliberate retardation of technological advancement by approximately 50 years, and making all the big events so important, I found that the whole vision of this 1960s incredibly drab. I mean, every single existence felt lonely and not very colourful at all. And you know that people are entertaining themselves and making social connections and everything, but everyone in the book feels isolated to me. I don't know if that's a fair impression, but obviously the signaller is isolated. Brother John is a very solitary figure, even though he is a figurehead to others. Our point of view character, Margaret, in Lords and Ladies, she is very much on her own, even though she's trying to make her way and better herself and make social connections. And this again resonated with this whole idea of a very sparse and lonely landscape, which is not brightly illuminated, and where people are then alone with their own thoughts and susceptible to the idea of, yes, there are supernatural entities and there are fairies. One of the things that I think would make this a bit more everyday would be more evidence of entertainments. And I'm wondering what all these people actually do for fun. Because, well, we know they go to the pub. It sounds like they go to the pub and otherwise beat their children for entertainment, and that's about it. yes, the lords and ladies have, they'll have their grand balls, and they'll occasionally condescend to invite commoners to them. But otherwise, it all seems very, very serious. And for that, ever so slightly not real.
Do you think that's the authors making kind of a counter argument to this nostalgia of like the good old times when things were simpler?
It could well be. Yeah, I think that is a fair point.
That does speak to another theme, because I'd say every one of their point of view characters in all of the measures, they are all very lonely in one way or another. None of them have close friends. None of them are close to their families, if they still have families. You know, they are all isolated. Mm-hmm. You know, the signaller, absolutely physically isolated as well as mentally isolated.
Yes. Mm-hmm. This was the general feeling I've got. So there's this idea that the Pavane, I'm not sure if it's Pavane or Pavan, because I think it might come from the French or the Latin, which is pronounced Pavan, but I'm not sure, honestly. Let's go with Pavane because we've started.
I'm willing to buy that. I certainly don't have any insight into the pronunciation. So
I don't feel strongly. I mean, it's certainly got to be a French word, but is it an anglicized French word?
But so it's not. I think your point is exactly on about loneliness. But it's even a particular kind of loneliness. So for the most part, even if these characters have a reason to, they're not bitter at other people. They don't really blame other people. They've been disappointed, you know, by other people in some instances. But I wonder, they seem very reflective, kind of well, you mentioned that in many cases they have kind of dream sequences or hallucination, light hallucination kind of thing. So I'm wondering if it's, they almost seem like visionaries. Or mystics or something, don't they?
Yeah, and that's quite. I mean, that's very. You know, it's only in the case I'll say of Brother John where this is sort of the defining trait. They are all dreamers. Even Jesse, actually, at the start, who goes into making lots of money, does that because of his dreams.
Yeah, I mean, his dreams are a little more down to earth, but they are totally aspirational. One thing I forgot, but I want to also mention is that Margaret seems unusually psychically sensitive. And I don't mean that sort of that in a way of actual, she has psychic powers, woo, but she has a strong sense of the supernatural resonances in Jesse's house. Actually, is it Jesse's house or is it her house? I'm not sure. But there's this big discussion about the apparent presences that exist in that place. And this put me in mind that, you know, maybe she is actually in touch with, well, you could argue that it is another supernatural world, or you could argue that she is imaginative and therefore susceptible to the ideas of the fairies, one way or the other.
Yeah. Did you feel that, so you mentioned this episode with Margaret, I felt like both in that episode and in the brother Jesse, when he's watching the blind quarryman work, that there's almost a suggestion of a Faustian deal
yes.
that's been struck. Right. So I know I didn't think I was imagining that, but
this deal was never spelled out, of course, but that is the feeling, I guess.
Yeah, the writing is so lyrical in places that sometimes you I found myself going back a couple paragraphs a number of times to try to establish in my head what just happened. And sometimes you could, and sometimes it's still slightly imprecise even after you've sort of tried to break the sentences down and decide what just happened. And I actually really enjoyed that. It was a little disorienting at times, but there's a couple passages that were just absolutely brilliant, I think, in that regard. And I'll just read one real quickly because it's only two or three sentences. But this is his description of a full on battle. He says, soldiers of the blue attacked, but there were too many. A charge, a scattering, a man pulled down, trampled and cut, screams tossed away by the wind, a red thing left shaking on the grass, a horse running riderless stabbed bloody by the pikes. The papists withdrew. So that's your whole battle in just a couple, you know, not even full sentences, right? And there's lots of little passages like that that punctuate the writing that leave it. That involve the reader a lot in the story or in the reading of the story in a very interactive way. He's not going to just lay it out for you very simply and say, here's what's happening, here's the answer, here's what the characters think.
I think it's very Vancean. It's kind of the sort of thing that you get from Jack Vance, particularly when, you know, things like Lyonesse, the economy of language to convey a lot of different things happening.
I believe that's right. I've noticed the same thing in C.J. Cherry, which I'm not a huge reader of, but we read one for the book club a couple months back, and I remember having to really focus on it, where I thought she was saying very simple things. I had to keep rereading passages to try to figure out what just happened. So maybe I'm a little dense.
I had the same with C.J. Cherry. I found this. Yeah, I did reread something else. I never found that a chore. Sometimes with C.J. Cherry, I found it was a chore. Again, the same
thing. I would agree with that. Vance, even though he's imprecise, sometimes is in a wonderful way imprecise, right?
Oh, yeah. It's very playful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is my third reading of Pavan. Some of the things I've enjoyed coming back to and some of the things I have, they've made me think about the story in new ways. I think the first time I read it, I did take it extremely literally and... I'll say that the other way around. The first time I read it, I think I did suspect all the while that the fairies could not possibly actually be supernatural and there must be a human explanation for them. And on the subsequent readings, I actually decided to think, well, no, why not? Why do they have to be? And I think that should be an open question. Okay, are there any other things you want to pick out?
I did want to say I feel like this is a novel about Great Britain's independence, right? I mean, I think, yeah, so that's something that's worth thinking about because it's essentially, we start off with a Great Britain that's very heavily influenced by outside forces and doesn't have some of the things that, was trying to market as a nation have been suppressed. And then by the end, we have a different kind of Great Britain. And so I thought that was an interesting angle. And of course, we haven't talked about it a lot because I think it's a very straightforward theme, but the science versus the church thing is something most readers are familiar with as a theme, but that's obviously a theme that a huge theme in the work.
Yeah, agreed. I've got one. I've got a couple of other things I'd like to say in this section. One of them is I was reading a review of Pavane, and I can't remember where it was. I'm going to put it down in the show notes. But the reviewer essentially said, well, there's been a slow, stately building of this world to immerse the reader, and where you can visualize the alternative timeline that has played out. And the coda undoes that very quickly, and in some ways is, therefore, it's unnecessary and it's jarring. I was wondering what you both felt about the coda, because it does slightly change one's perspective on the rest of the book. I think it's good, but I'd like your opinion. Maybe Paul?
Okay, with the coda, I mean, that brought home to me what you were saying. Reading the coda, I didn't think, oh, that can't be true. But I was thinking, that's subjective, that's point of view, looking back on it. It doesn't seem to me the point of view of the coda is absolutely what happened.
I read that same criticism, and I thought I wanted to buy into that. So I read the coda, and I think, this is trash. Why does this need to be on here? I think the story would be better without it. But the more I thought about it, the more I felt like the coda was important structurally. I tried to imagine the story ending where the sixth measure ends, and I felt like that was unsatisfying, so it needed something. And I agree, Paul, that it doesn't really, for me, even though it feels like it knits everything and kind of answers questions, I don't really feel like it changes anything. I feel like it's just more of a bit of a kind of a closure, I guess. It provides closure. Beyond that, I sort of suspected that the world was heading in this direction, and we still have this open question about the fairies, and it was kind of just a nice little end cap.
So my view of the coda is, I think it's necessary, so I agree with you. The other thing I think it does is that the coda kind of, it makes it explicit that technological advances have been retarded by about half a century. And this is why we have effectively 1910, 1920s technology in the latter half of the 20th century. And that works for me. And also that there are reasons why this was actually a beneficial thing rather than a harmful thing. And that I felt was interesting as well. But the thing the coda does for me most of all is that it's been topped and tailed with the prologue, given the reason why things have deviated from our current timeline. And then it's been tailed off with the coda. And the whole thing then is basically packaged as a thought exercise about what if, what would happen? Would we still go more or less on the same? Would the British Isles be predestined to be self-governing in the style of government that followed the Reformation anyway, regardless of whether this hiccup happened and that we ended up under several centuries of authoritarian rule under the Catholic Church? So this, I think the coda turns it into an interesting thought experiment. The one thing that I am interested in the coda is exactly who is the observer here. It does suggest that there are actually external observers who are aware of everything that has gone on and have otherwise been unmoved by it. So this, if you want to talk about the fairies as other people who are just observers, are they actually even part of this world, or are they from outside it? And that is maybe a slight spoiler, but I think you can, it's a question to me, and I think it's part of the ambiguity.
Again, going back to the coda, I think this point that when I was saying the REF, this retardation technology, that was a beneficial effect, I thought, yes, the person writing that believes it. Like that. It's not the author, it's whoever, the fictional author of the coda.
Yes.
I agree. That was an interesting. That's an interesting thing to add. That it might have been beneficial, and it definitely reads like a bit of an opinion to me. Maybe the author's opinion, not the more so than the writer of the letter who's expressing that opinion. And I think as a spoiler, when you say that's a bit of a spoiler, I think in some ways, when I get to the end of this book, I immediately sort of wanted to reread it, and I think that's the. asking these questions that get us, so they grow over time as you read it, where you're trying to figure out the answer to these questions and you think you're going to get paid off. By the end, you know that these are like a little bit like thought exercises. So these questions are established in your head. Now I want to go back and read the whole book again with these questions in my head. And I have a feeling every time you reread this, you may come up with a different answer.
Agreed. Yeah, that is pretty much how I feel about it. Shall we move on to the role-playing bit?
Yes.
I think last time we started with Ray, so Paul, have you got any ideas for role-playing games, given your penchant for historical role-playing?
I think I'd actually would. Yeah, absolutely. So I think I would stick with a pretty traditional system, just for this emphasis on the setting. I'd possibly use Mythmas. And one reason I like the idea of this is in one of the books there, Mythic Britain, there's this idea where it blurs the lines between magic and superstition. Indeed, any character has a superstition skill, which helps them interpret omens and so on, but does make them more vulnerable to what may or may not be magic.
Cool. Basically use the landscape around...
Yes, the landscape is the thing. And also, I mean, in this case, it's a relatively, gritty, nasty system, also quite realistic. And I think that's what's needed for traditional system for this type of thing.
Nice. Ray, have you got any ideas?
I do. I struggled with this one a little bit. I think, like Paul said, my first thought was to kind of go towards a traditional system, and things like Into the Odd popped up into my head. But ultimately, I ended up feeling like I wanted something kind of different. This story has such a long scope. I thought about Microscope. But I settled on two different ideas systematically. One of them is Callisto, which is a game by Brad Murray. And it's a game that's played out through letter writing. And so I thought something on this large time scale, with many characters, might play out really well as kind of a play by post or play by email letter writing kind of storytelling event.
About Callisto, are you aware of De Profundis?
I've heard of it. I've not played it.
Okay, well, I'm going to check out Callisto because I have played De Profundis. In fact, Paul and I played De Profundis. I think we were kind of the last couple of letter writers standing. Indeed, it's kind of a that was an exercise in endurance, really, and some people sort of peeled off pretty quickly.
Which it shouldn't have been. I mean, Callisto looks more attainable than De Profundis for the simple reason you can bang out quick emails rather than spending your time crafting a reasonable and long letter.
Right.
De Profundis game, Ralph, but I spent a lot of time on those letters.
I played Callisto with an online community of about, I would say 16 people, something like that, intensely for maybe a month. And it was great fun. Having said that, my one reservation was I was the GM or the arbitrator of all these letters, right? And so I got to see everybody's letters, whereas from the player perspective, they don't always get to see everybody else's letters or want to, if they want to stay in character. And I think that is a problem that you ultimately have to solve. You almost need to have closing points or a play in segments where you play for a little while and then you do a little bit of a wrap up. So everybody gets the information and shares so they can see all the cool things that are going on. And then you kind of launch into another sprint of letter writing. But it was great fun. The other game system I thought about was Itris B, which is seems like it doesn't fit at all because it's set in kind of surrealistic, it's kind of a European surrealistic kind of Art Deco, Art Nouveau kind of time period. But what I like about it is the resolution engine has two types of cards. One is answers. You pose a fictional question about whether you achieve something, and the card will answer, yes, but something else happens. Yes, or no, but something else happens. Those kinds of resolutions. So you don't really need stats or anything like that. You just need some idea what your character is good at to play with that mechanic. And then they have these other cards called chance cards, which introduce a surrealistic element. And I would probably rewrite those to fit a setting like Pavan. But what I like about that is, I mean, Pavan has these moments that get kind of surrealistic or visionary or something. And I think it might be kind of cool to have a mechanic that interrupts and brings in some elements that were unexpected. And then finally, I'm just going to mention this because, and I have to mention his name because he's really the reason why we have a tabletop role-playing book club community. He goes by Apocryphal Chris online, and he and I had a discussion online about using some kind of meta sliders, he called them. I was just thinking like where you track the forces, and he called them tradition, faith, and science. And so I'm going to read you what he wrote because I thought it's we were kind of in sync on this, and I think but he said it very well. He said he'd like to, he says, one idea I like is trying to explore a setting through a series of one-shot vignettes to make a small campaign. Maybe in each subsequent vignette, one character is a descendant of a previous one. Of course, I'm always trying to explore a setting, so that's not groundbreaking. But maybe you could give the setting a couple of sliding scales that describe the mood of the place. After each vignette, you ask some questions of the players about the game you just played and adjust the scales a little according to the answers. Then the next scenario, the setting is a little different, reflecting the new score. Even how you describe things, like the weather, is different. I was thinking that the scales might be something like tradition, faith, and science. And with each level on the scale, you get a page describing what that means. I would include adjustments to how NPCs are played, descriptive adjectives, aspects, and I think he means like fate-like aspects in that regard. The point being that the PCs have the ability to change the setting with each scenario in ways that reflect their character's behavior, so their actions are plugged into the system, which processes them and spits out tangible changes to the setting to be experienced in the next round. So I thought that was a really great idea for playing out the system.
Thank you for sharing that. That sounds brilliant.
Props to Chris for that one.
Thank you, Chris. I've got a couple of ideas I had. One of the things that you mentioned was kind of riffing off what you just said about a set of vignettes and characters plugging into the setting and then changing it. I want to just quickly mention Elizabeth Lovegrove's Rise and Fall, which is essentially about rise and fall of a dystopian regime. This, of course, is over a much longer period of time, and it's also in that kind of genre. If you want to actually talk about the change of a world, you could also pick something like Microscope or Kingdom. One of the things that Rise and Fall does is it has the idea of playing characters who are thematically one type of avatar, but you don't necessarily play the same character each time. And so they may have a theme of law enforcement or big corporations, or they may be medical staff or something like that. With that idea, you could simplify the way that you frame the scenes and then use that mechanism to generate an alternate history. I think the only thing I've got about Rise and Fall, though, is that it's a game where you know what the start conditions are and you know what the end conditions are, that the regime rises and then it comes down again. And obviously this is what happens in Pavane, but do you really want to play that? I think it's good fun, but it depends how much agency you want the characters to have. The other thing I wanted to mention was going back to this idea about how light is expensive and how only the rich can really afford to illuminate their houses, and therefore the division between day and night becomes much, much more important when you're in a rural community and you're poor. And you have an oppressive regime that controls access to electricity. So I'm thinking about basically the kind of game that maybe much more like something like Sagas of the Icelanders, I'm thinking, a sort of which that tends to be focused around a family unit or a small community, but to actually consider what happens during the day and what happens during the night and how the tension and the susceptibility to imagine strange things, fairies, and be frightened goes up at night, and then to have a sharp contrast between day scenes and night scenes. Now, I'm not sure which system I'd use for that. I mean, a good dramatic type system could be an apocalypse world type game. could also be a drama system type game. I'm a fan of Hill Folk and a big fan of Melandros. That could work if you actually introduce that. But what I'd really want to focus on would be the difference between the day and the night and how people's beliefs and sensibilities are heightened as it goes into the night time and what they believe. And the sort of feel that I'm imagining is, I don't know if you know M. Night Shyamalan's The Village?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I thought I was the only person I knew.
well, I have a love-hate relationship with it. but I think that that is possibly the best representation of what I'm thinking of, what's in my head about this. And obviously in that one, you've got a community that appears to be a 19th century American close community where they have some sort of arrangement with the creatures in the woods and those who come at night and wear the colour red, etc. I think it's really quite special, apart from, well, the ending and, you know, the bits where they spoil everything. That's the problem. But you've got but one of the things that happens at night is you notice that unless you've got a place that's illuminated, everything's pitch black outside, and there's even, say, something about 50 feet away where the houses, the main street is quite wide. You can have something walking down the middle of the main street, and it actually can't be visible from either house. So you've always got this uncertainty that if you want to cross the street and make contact with your neighbour at night, are you going to encounter anything on the way? And that's the kind of feel that I'd like to get. I'm a big fan of like close communities and the idea of a village community where it's safe, and then the characters have to venture outside that. I've talked about Beyond the Wall in past quite extensively in different games, and I think that is the thing I think is very interesting.
Well, I was just going to comment on that because I really like the idea of a game played in kind of two phases or alternating phases like that. The closest parallel I could think of, the game is completely on a different genre, but the way Night Witches works has that kind of, very distinctive phases, right?
Right.
So I think that would, you know, that'd be a great structure to switch from daytime to nighttime and have almost completely different rules, you know, for the nighttime phase.
I've got a game in the pipeline which also considers, it's basically, it's a dystopian science fiction thing, so it's nothing like this, but it is there's a world in the city, and then there's a world of adventure outside the city, and the idea is that you go outside to have adventures and then you come back and you have dramatic relationships with inside the city. And I would like to see more of this type of game. I understand that The Watch is influenced by Night Witches, although I'm fairly ignorant of it. That that idea, and then Melandros is, you've got the a very nice setup where you have dramatic scenes and you have procedural scenes where you can have the action. I think that this is so simple, and yet there's an awful lot that you can do with it. So that was, anyway, that's me gushing about that. Yeah, that's what I would do. Okay, it sounds like we're coming to the end, unless I'm mishearing that. Is there anything else that you gentlemen would like to say about role-playing games?
No, I do. I will say this. This is from reading a number of different books in the book club. Sometimes I'm surprised because the books that I think are the ones that are going to lend themselves most likely lend themselves to role-playing ideas often peter out very quickly. And the books where I'm wrestling with how in the world would I use this in a game become the richest, you know, field for harvesting ideas. And Pavan is one of those where you're reading it and you're thinking, okay, this is a great book, but how does this relate to role-playing? And then the ideas start coming, and you have much more interesting ideas, I think, from a book like this than you would from reading a kind of a straight adventure novel.
Yeah, there's some types of fiction which are quite straightforward to steal ideas from role-playing games. They're not necessarily the best things to read.
And there are some types of fiction which basically read like role-playing games to start with.
Yeah.
Sort of Throne of the Crescent Moon, I think. I think that's got to be somebody's D&D campaign, but we've already done that one anyway. All right. Well, it sounds like we're coming towards a sort of a nice end. Final comments on the book on Keith Roberts' work, or any other recommendations you'd like to make. So, Ray, would you like to? Do you have any final words you'd like to say?
I think I kind of said what I wanted to say. I'll cap it off with, this is my first time reading this author, and it probably won't be my last.
Excellent, thank you, and yeah. And Paul.
I did love this book. I mean, one thing I'll say to our listeners here is possibly parts of this discussion have made it sound like a very difficult book. It's not. You know, don't go in intimidated by it. It's a fun read, and it's a fun read to think about it also.
I totally agree. All right. Well then, I'm going to say thank you very much to both of you. Thank you, Paul. And thank you very much for joining us, Ray. Excellent to meet you.
Thank you. It was a really, really fun time.
Okay.
And it's nice to see you face to face one after. Go interactions online. It's excellent.
Okay. Well then, and that is our show. Thanks for listening to our podcast. If you've got comments, we'd love to hear them. We're on the web and on social media. Details at fictoplasm.net. Until next time, bye.